Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Julia Fashaw. How are you doing, Julia?
Good, John. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. And Phil Oakley, how are you, Phil?
Not bad, thanks, John.
Excellent. And Phil, you've this week written in your Alpha newsletter lots of stuff that is in your sector, Julia, so we can have an excellent debate here today. And also there's been some big news stories also in your sector, Julia. It's been a busy week for you.
It has been a busy week.
So busy that you haven't actually had time to cover all the results.
But, yeah, no, some of them had to be picked up by others. But.
Indeed, but we're all on the same page. So we're going to talk about Unilever. We're going to talk about Stagecoach, which you did write, and Phil's got some old war stories from that sector. We're going to talk about Stobart, another transportation story which we have talked about previously, but there was a big development there this week, and some other stuff from the food and drink industry, which seems very appropriate just before Christmas. Where should we start? Shall we start with the first page of the news section then, Stobart, which has cut its fourth quarter dividend. This can't have gone down well.
No, the shares certainly did go down. But yeah, it's the first stage of what they've called this capital review, and if the first step is to cut the dividend, it's not really looking too optimistic. It's quite disappointing because we tipped Stobart about a year ago, I think.
Mm.
And we tipped it in part as an income play, since at that point, like, dividends had before that been yielding about 8%. And while that does seem like it should be a red flag, the company was adamant that they had this structure where asset sales should back up the dividend until about 2023, at which point their plans to increase the capacity in the energy business and also expand London South End Airport.
London South End? That's stretching it a bit.
Every single time, you always get on that point.
It's just ridiculous. Anyway, sorry.
But at that point, profits from those expansions were expected to kind of take over and maintain the dividend from there, and that's clearly unraveled in the past 12 months.
What's gone wrong? There's been a bit of a boardroom shenanigans going on.
Yeah, I mean, we tipped it about a year ago, and ever since, it's just been a bit of a dog's breakfast ever since then, starting with the kind of board infighting where the founder tried to get rid of the chairman, and it backfired, but, still quite a significant proportion of shareholders did vote to kick him out, and he is going to step down next year. The transport industry itself has certainly been a difficult place to be operating in right now.
Yeah, but Stobart's not a big airport. I mean, London South End Airport, it's not a big airport. You know, Ryanair's coming in.
Ryanair and EasyJet have quite big operations there. But plans to, anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. EasyJet's definitely there. Ryanair are coming in. Mm. Flybe obviously is there. Not so great, this sounded like a nice little structural growth story here for a smaller operator
in
the sector.
It's quite disappointing. I've now taken it to a hold just because it's kind of unraveled since then. But yeah, between the growth story with Southend and the energy business and these kind of generous dividend payments, it seemed like a good play at the time, and it just hasn't panned out.
Tell me about the energy business. I don't really. This is the kind of less exciting side of things, but I mean, again, you would have thought biomass, it's kind of in the renewable space. This is a good place to be.
Yeah, you'd think so. And the kind of one of the ambitions for that is they wanted to have sort of end to end, like fully integrated. And they're still planning to. I mean, the plans is that by 2022 they'll be able to supply 3 million tons of biomass per year.
And it's growing fast.
And
that side of things.
It's on track. I mean, we should caveat this in the sense that I have taken it to a hold, but there isn't really anything to suggest that they can't achieve these goals. The two main goals are 3 million tons of biomass per year by 2020 and then having 5 million passengers through London Southend Airport Southend Airport.
Call it what they like. It's got a train into London, I suppose.
That's true. But yeah, having 5 million passengers in by then. And it's making progress on both these fronts. And so these goals still look achievable, but in the meantime, I think it's just best to move to the sidelines for now, just in case. I mean, it seems like they've kind of made a lot of grand promises and then things unravel.
Yeah, the dividend's still not awful.
No.
It's
3.4% is nothing to scoff at, but
no. Not terrible at all. But anyway, we're less bullish than we were, but not bailing entirely, because there could be some better news on the horizon.
Yeah, there's still light at the end of the tunnel.
Absolutely. Let's stick to transport and Stagecoach, which I know you covered in the results section. Stagecoach, I mean, the entire transport industry, the passenger transport industry, has looked horrible for years. And I know, Phil, this is kind of where you cut your teeth in the city. Tell us your stagecoach war story before we come on to the meat of this latest update.
When I started out as a city transport analyst nearly 20 years ago now, my first ever job when I walked into the office was the company I was working for, the broker that I walked into, was arranging or part of the fundraising, equity fundraising, to buy for Stagecoach, to buy this business called Coach USA, which was a, you know, mishmash of different bus businesses in terms of, you know, regular transit, commuter buses, big sightseeing businesses. They even had a taxi business when they bought the business. And that was my baptism of fire, having to try and go around and sell this deal to investors to part with their money and fund Stagecoach acquisition of Coach USA. And pretty much after a few months after they bought this business, problems started to appear. And it seems that they've never really gone away. Stagecoach, the amount of write-offs of goodwill and asset value write-offs has been absolutely massive. I forget the price that they paid for this. I think it was something, $1.5 billion or something like that from memory, maybe a little bit more. I mean, a lot of that has been burnt, really, been destroyed.
So I guess the big news this week is what you've covered in the results, is that this business that has proved so problematic over the years, they're now selling.
Hindsight, if only you'd known at the time, but just coach businesses in North America have been just turned into a bit of a disaster. First Group did something similar recently too, when they sold part of the Canadian operation for their Greyhound bus business. Mm. And yeah. Now Stagecoach is trying to get rid of it. It's put it up for sale. It hasn't sold it yet.
Do we know what price is looking for?
No, they haven't said anything. I asked, but anything, they were quite tight-lipped.
Anything you can get.
I mean, the market seemed happy. The market seemed very happy that with this news.
Yeah, I mean, it's just because these businesses have been a drag on things like First Group and Stagecoach. It's just there's no growth there. It's the now that short-haul airfares have become much cheaper, there's just not really any incentive to sit on a bus for 10 hours when you can be there in probably two on a plane.
Yeah, it's a big old place, America.
Mm. I remember actually when I was out there on that trip, and someone was talking about the long distance coach business, and the comment that came out was that the only people that really got on those buses was someone who'd just come out of the asylum.
A friend of mine did travel. A friend of mine got married in Houston, and another friend decided to extend his holiday and travel from Houston to Austin on a Greyhound bus. He said it was one of the most terrifying experiences of his life.
Greyhound has a terrible reputation in Canada. I'm Canadian, but because there were people that were decapitated on it.
Not on a bus that you've been on.
No. I was not on the bus at the time, but yeah, it was a few years ago. It made headlines everywhere, and I think it happened twice. And so, even just weird things like that, they just really bad reputation.
Yeah. So I mean, let's go back to Stagecoach, just away from decapitation.
Yeah.
Now that Stagecoach has been decapitated, this troublesome bus business, North American bus business, what's left? So the market like this, the shares are up as a result. But what's left?
I mean,
do we really like what's left?
Not particularly. I mean, we have it on a sell. So, the first thing that jumps to mind is UK Rail, which is a notoriously difficult business to run.
I mean, being a commuter, I would not put my money in UK Rail.
No, I mean, whenever I think of UK Rail, I just think of the National Express bosses saying there's no way in hell that they'd ever even consider going back into UK Rail. And the business has been better for it since.
They've learnt the hard way.
They did, yeah.
In fact, all of these main operators have... I think Rail used to be incredibly lucrative for these companies. And because you're dealing in a sector where there is very little growth, Rail franchise was seen as a source of profit growth. And it pushed up all the prices for them. Companies had to rely on very, very bullish projections of future revenue growth to try and make the deal stack up. And of course, those revenue projections never materialise, and you end up with you know, in Stagecoach's case, also National Express's case, on the same franchise, actually, the East Coast Main Line, massive, massive losses. And Stagecoach has got a problem with its rail business because most of its franchises now are going to run out next year. And it's going to be very interesting to see if it can retain East Midlands and its stake in Virgin Rail Group, because the East Coast debacle will not have won it any friends with the government. And it would be very interesting to see whether it lost Southwest Trains to First Group last year, which it had run since privatisation for over 20 years. And it's going to be very interesting to see whether they can retain these rail franchises and at what cost.
Mm. I mean, the whole rail franchising thing,
it's a completely flawed, broken model.
I mean, I've been commuting for, you know, from where I am for 10 years. I think we've had three operators in that time, you know.
And there's no difference. All that really happens is you get, yeah, from time to time, you get some new railing stock, which isn't financed by the rail franchisee.
Well, they're infrastructure companies, though.
It's financed by a bank.
Yep.
There's nothing that goes on the balance sheet, really, of these train operating companies. It's the same staff.
Big two-pay staff transfer.
So different uniforms, different paint on the coaches, pretty much the same service. It's complete nonsense of a system, which has not really delivered value for the taxpayer, or indeed for a lot of shareholders in rail companies.
And certainly not commuters. It's coming up to season ticket renewal time.
Well, we are the most expensive rail fares in Europe now.
It's horrifying how much I have to spend getting to work each year. Yeah. It does feel very much like shuffling the deck chairs around the Titanic of the UK rail industry. But but there you go. I mean, Stagecoach does have another business which is proving slightly more successful, which is the UK bus business.
Yeah, UK
but
buses.
But you have to wonder whether, you know, that too will become subject to the same politicisation as rail has.
Yeah, and I mean, UK bus has been better, but it hasn't been without its problems already. I mean, it's the regional services that have done quite well, which you would kind of think is because you don't really have the option to take the train.
Also, there's not many of them. I mean, the obligations that they are under in providing regional bus services, I mean, you know, certainly rural bus services, I mean, you know, it's a bus every 2 hours where I am.
Yeah, this hasn't worked either.
No, it hasn't.
And I think, you know, the political risk is that, you know, the London bus market has become a regulated bus market. And in some ways, the London bus market has worked quite well for passengers.
Yeah, it's cheap. £1.50 a day. Yeah.
Whereas the regional bus market, and this is the threat that comes up every few years, that local authorities or the government is going to take back control of regional bus market. It's going to become a regulated market. In some ways, actually, that may not be a bad thing. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a bad thing for companies, because you just don't know what price they're going to be done on.
Mm. But I mean, for me, a single journey, say, from Maldon to Chelmsford, £5.40. It's obscene. It's the same for school journeys. They're not that much cheaper.
I went with my son, 2 mile journey on the bus. We should have walked. I think it was raining, so we got the bus. And it would have been cheaper for me to park, cheaper for me to actually go and drive and park than for me and my son to get the bus. So the fares are completely out of kilter. So this industry is a mess as well, but there isn't really a lot of growth in it. I mean, if you look at the numbers, there was no mention in the statement of any passenger growth at all. I think they just jacked the fares up and got some lucrative bus rail replacement business from Derby. And of course, in London, where Stagecoach was in, out, back in again, it's not really working. So there isn't really a lot of growth in this business. I don't know what Julia thinks, but I don't think there's a lot of growth in this business.
Yeah, we've got it on a sell, so I definitely agree. It's not a good business to be in right now.
Not much love for this business, rather.
Really not.
Or affect the industry as a whole.
Yeah.
Should we turn some good news?
Let's
go to some good news. I know you didn't cover it this week, but you know it well, and Phil covered it in your Alpha update. Britvic, which is doing well. I mean, this was a company that over the years, you know, has had its fair share of troubles, but has really turned itself around.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, it seems like they've kind of their biggest achievement lately is just managing this transition of cutting the amount of sugar that's in their products quite well, and it's proving quite popular. And I guess it's the kind of motivated in two senses. One, from a tax sense, with this the sugar tax that was introduced on drinks back in April. And then also the trend that millennials just aren't really interested in sugary drinks anymore. And
They have a huge children's drink portfolio, so I guess that kind of plays right into that, you know.
Yeah, that as well.
You don't want to be feeding your children lots of sugar for the obvious reasons. But yeah, I mean, the sugar tax is not the only headwind they've had to overcome this year. I mean, all beverage companies have faced this carbon dioxide problem.
Yeah, it was a big one for the pub groups as well, actually. But
I think it was huge for everyone.
Yeah,
I
mean, it was a real and stuff. And anything that has any fizz to it. But
it was a real thing. I was up in Southwold and I spoke to the head brewer at Adnams, and yeah, no, it was a real thing. They were worried. Yeah. They were definitely worried. What do you make of Britvic, Phil? I know you're quite bullish on this.
I've always quite liked it, but it's always seemed to be fighting against something, fighting a fire somewhere over the years. And I think one of the things that makes it quite an attractive business is it does have a very decent portfolio of drink brands. Underpinning all of this is the license that they have to produce and sell Pepsi and 7-Up Lipton tea from PepsiCo in the UK and Ireland. Obviously on the sugar-free theme, Pepsi Max and 7-Up Free have been very much tuned into that market development. And then they back it up with a portfolio of their own brands like Robinson's, Fruit Shoot, R. White's is another one.
J2O. That's a biggie.
Yeah, and they've got a natural energy drink as well, which is doing well, called Purdy's. And this business is doing okay. You know, the soft drinks market also in the UK seems to be in quite a happy place right now. And for a lot of years, a lot of aggressive discounting in this market made it very difficult in terms of pricing and preserving and grab for sales and margin. And it seems quite calm at the moment. And I think there's a good chance of it staying that way. But I think one of the other things I like about this company is that it's been investing a lot of money in production and distribution assets.
It's moved its head office, didn't it? Used to be Chelmsford.
Used to be about a mile and a half from where I live.
Not anymore.
And the building's been empty for about 5 years.
Has it really? Yeah.
And they made Pepsi on the other side of Chelmsford. And then they had a big factory at Norwich as well. And the Norwich factory's about being closed down, the Chelmsford factory's being closed down. And what they've got now is they've got what they refer to quite eloquently as a spine going right up in the middle of England. So starting at London, Rugby, and then Leeds. And this is going to create a much more efficient distribution. It gives them capacity to grow, but it also takes out costs. You have fewer road miles, and you get an efficiency gain, a distribution gain with modern, well-invested plant. And this has been sucking cash out of the business for the last couple of years, and this is going to stop. So I think that the sales part of Britvic is in a reasonably good place now. I think that sales forecasts look a bit light to me, and I think we've got the possibility now of some potential margin kicker from this more efficient distribution production facilities that they've got. And then you've got a big cash flow kicker as well as the CapEx comes down from like 130, 140 million, probably to half that level. So you're going to get a lot of cash flow. The debt's going to come down. It supports the dividend. And adding that up with the fact that you've got a share trading on, what, just over 14 times next 12 months earnings, 3.5% dividend yield, something like that. I'd rather own this share than Fever-Tree. I think this is maybe not as exciting, but if you look at the risk-reward trade-off, you look at the valuation involved here, I quite like this.
I have to say, that share price, I mean, it's a rare sight in the current market to see one that's going north rather than south.
Yeah, true. I mean, they're trading at a bit of a premium to their kind of history, but I mean, the way that Phil puts it, it sounds like it's well deserved.
But when you talk about the history, I mean, the history, as I mentioned earlier, was beset with problems.
Yes,
so you know,
true.
they were always trading at a discount to their long history because they had so many problems. So maybe we need to perhaps have a think about this one.
It's a different business as well. It's, you know, like AG Barr, these guys own their production assets. Whereas Fever-Tree and Nichols, who make Vimto, they don't. So it is always going to look not going to look as profitable or cash generative or return on capital as those other two businesses. But you've got a very nicely well diversified portfolio of brands there, which I quite like.
Yeah, it's got some international stuff that's not doing quite so well at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. France and Brazil in particular during the reported period were rather difficult. But I mean, most of their business is in the UK, so...
Yeah, the Irish business has been doing very well, and they've bought some extra distribution there as well, which will help them in that market as well.
Right.
So this is one of the few shares I quite like right now.
Wow. Wow, the Oakley seal of approval. Crumbs.
For a miserable person like me, yeah.
Let's stick with drinks and go back to the new spotlight. And this is a drink that I know you don't like, Phil. Horlicks. He's nodding his head and looking like he's about to be sick.
He's looking all disgusted right now.
So, yeah, Horlicks was part of GSK's consumer goods portfolio, and it sold it.
Yeah, it sold it to Unilever for 3.3 billion euros.
Yeah, that's a big number. That can't just be Horlicks, then.
No, it's they describe it as GSK's health food drinks portfolio in India, Bangladesh, and 20 other predominantly Asian markets.
Yeah, so there's a funny story behind this, isn't there? Why Horlicks is popular in the Indian subcontinent?
I think there's a very strong tradition in India of parents, mothers giving Horlicks to their children.
Absolutely.
As a food supplement and health product.
Yeah.
Though if you go elsewhere, there'll be some people who say it's anything but healthy, this drink.
It's certainly not healthy the way I...
It's milk, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that particularly healthy?
But it has immense brand power. Obviously, Unilever have got a foothold in the Indian market, but I've not seen how much profit it made. Did they disclose a figure how much money it was making?
For that specific division at GSK.
How much was Horlicks making in terms of profit?
In 2018, it made 550 million euros in sales.
Right.
But it doesn't give a profit figure.
So they've paid...
But 90% of this is coming from India as well.
So they paid 6.5 and a bit times sales for it.
Yeah, it's a pricey deal.
But they've always wanted that emerging India's, markets exposure.
Yeah, India in particular too, but yeah, emerging markets in general. It's in that sense, I mean, it's a good deal for them on two fronts, really. It's the emerging market exposure, increasing that. And also, they say it also plays into this idea of, the health food trend, but I...
Well, that's why.
It is.
That's why. It's
a different
thing.
One that they've been kind of arguing recently. Before, when they've been like, we really want to pursue this trend of healthy lifestyle, it's been when they've bought all those tea brands. Like they bought Puka last year, and they've it's been things like that. So Horlicks seems to be kind of a different kind of healthy lifestyle. But it is.
But it has a health angle. As I was going to say earlier, it's not healthy the way I drink. I have a Horlicks before bed every now and then, but with a nice little bit of rum in the tub. That's quite nice.
I think there was a lot of competition for this. I know a few months ago, AB Foods talked about looking at this business, but I think they were determined not to pay a silly price for it.
Yeah, I mean, looking at that valuation, you'd think there must have been quite a lot of bidding competition for this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of Paul Palmer's last hurrah as well, and I think we've talked about that on this podcast.
Yeah, he's stepping down in the new year. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, not taking a backseat to deal-making just yet.
No.
One last hurrah after
it's been a horrible year.
It's not been a good year for him. No.
No. As they said in the Spectator article, which is where I read about the Indian maternity angle to Horlicks. The Horlicks comparison with how he handled the UK head office thing was made, and it's fair. That kind of did for him, really.
Yeah. No. I think. I mean, there had been talk about him retiring for a while, but I mean, you could speculate that maybe expedited the process a little bit.
Do we know who's coming in his place?
Yeah, his name's Alan Jope. He's currently the head of personal care. So nice internal transfer.
Yeah.
Seems to be taken quite well.
Yeah.
Here to the business.
And we like it too, because we've obviously kept the shares on a buy, despite the recent troubles.
Yeah. And this deal, it looks like it'll be a good one. I mean, the emerging markets division of Unilever has been growing fairly well. It was at sales growth of, I think, 4.5%. At the last set of results. So, I mean, for a consumer goods business, I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Just while we're on that page, GSK, obviously the seller of that, has already spent some of the money on a big acquisition this week, which I don't think the market was massively keen on. In the oncology space, I think. But I struggle to keep up with pharmaceuticals, I have to say. Let's stick with the same page. We talked about it very briefly last week, but we've got the Dignity thing here, which you can read a bit more about. We spoke about it last week, so we don't really need to go into that again. Let's now move over to Phil's column, because this week you've looked at Rightmove, which is another company that can seem to do no wrong. And you've kind of run the Phil slide rule over it, kicked the tyres. What have you found, Phil?
I can see why a lot of people like this business. I don't think I've come across a business in over 20 years I've been doing this that is as impressive in churning out profits, return on investment, cash flows, and growing at the same time. I think this is probably the most profitable business on the London Stock Exchange, in terms of profit margins, free cash flow margins, return on capital. And it's been growing at the same time. And it ticks a lot of boxes in terms of a business that has one of those common terms that we hear now, an economic moat. It is a business that, when it's as profitable as that, you expect a lot of competition.
And there is some competition.
There is some competition. You have Zoopla, obviously, and on the market as well. But they have not managed to dislodge this company or throw it off course. And one of the things I look into, I spend a lot of time in the column actually, is looking at, you know, how resilient this business actually is. And you know, one of the key drivers of its success is that it's been able to drive up something called the average revenue per advertiser by an incredible amount. In the last 10, 11 years, the average revenue per advertiser has increased fourfold. And given that Rightmove has a lot of fixed costs, the leverage on that growth is amazing in terms of how it's just fed through to incremental profits, incremental cash flows. Companies use that cash flow to retire about a third of the shares. And so you've had a turbocharged business and turbocharged investment. The issue is now, obviously, how sustainable is this? Because it's not really a secret that if you look at a state agency, this is a business that's facing up, who are the main customers of Rightmove. It's more than three quarters of the business, with house builders being, you know, the next sort of 20-odd percent. State agents are facing up to a lot of problems now. And, you know, when you've been asked to pay £1,000 a month on average per branch to Rightmove every month, that is a significant overhead. When the number of instructions, if you don't sell, you don't get paid. And the number of instructions, the number of sales is going down. So a state agency is really being squeezed, not only by a slowing market, but pressures on commissions. The rental business, which has kept a lot of estate agents afloat over the last decade, tenant fees are being banned next year. So there's a chunk of margin coming out of that business. And what I'm essentially asking is that is Rightmove in danger of biting the hand that feeds it? In that how much more can it keep pushing by asking estate agents to pay more and more and more of their monthly overhead over to them?
I guess, though, Rightmove has been a beneficiary. So, you know, the extra expenditure that estate agents have put through Rightmove is money that those estate agents would have once spent advertising, for example, in the local paper.
This is the bull case for this is what this was actually brought up about 2 years ago, just under 2 years ago, when the figure of £2,500 per month was mentioned, which is what the estate agents on average were spending with local newspapers in terms of advertising their properties.
And local newspapers, I mean, they're dying. There's no other way.
They're pretty much dead.
They're pretty much dead. We saw Johnson Press the other week, you know, having an absolute shocker.
Yeah.
And that malaise is there's no turnaround in sight there.
And of course, the development of digital advertising has brought down, has massively increased competition in advertising, and it puts pressure on rates. So I'm not convinced that this 2,500. Now, the Bulls of Rightmove will, you know, may say, look, company wants to get to 2,500. State agency has changed. You know, we have a different housing market now. We have a very difficult housing market. We have a lot of competition. We have the online agencies who are trying to make money and not making money.
And, in fact, one of them went into administration this week.
E-Move, yeah. And you know, Purple Bricks, I think that's barely, that's just profitable in the UK, but not very much. And the pool of cash that these agents have is under pressure.
I mean, the fact that these alternative models of estate agency are struggling, does that kind of say, though, that, you know, the sort of predictions of the demise of traditional high street estate agency were rather premature?
Maybe, but I think there's just too many estate agents. It's, you know, you talk about how, you know, I talk on one hand how tough estate agent is, but actually there's more than there ever has been. You know, the barriers to entry of setting up an estate agency is actually quite low. And some of these agents, or, you know, well, they're still paying Rightmove. They feel that they have to be on there. This is a website which is one of the most popular websites in the UK, and it has become the go-to place for people looking to buying houses or renting houses. And the agents, the level of retention is sort of 94%. So these customers are not moving away from Rightmove, despite the alternative of Zoopla. And then you've got an upstart in the form of On The Market,
which was set up by estate agents.
Set up about 3 and a bit years ago, called Agents Mutual, I think the name was. And this was all about trying to curb the dominance of Rightmove. And it's not really been managed as well as it could have been. And it's listed on the AIM market, and it's got some money, and it's moved away from being a mutual. Now it's got shareholders to please, which, you know, may cloud its business strategy a bit. But what it's been doing, it's been offering free 12-month trials to agents. And it's now got about 11,000 advertisers. Rightmove's about 17,500. Zoopla's about 15,500. And obviously the agents say, well, if it's free, I'm going to take it. And what On The Market is hoping is that after the free period has expired, that these agents stay with it. But That remains to be seen. I mean, Rightmove is trying very, very hard. It's not just an advertiser. It does offer a lot of data services, branding, marketing help for agents. It's not just an advertiser. It's trying to offer more products to get the average spend up. And obviously, for some agents, that is worthwhile. For the smaller sort of one-man band agents, I'm not so sure. But I think probably what will happen that makes life difficult for Rightmove is the next housing market downturn.
Yeah, and if you look at that average revenue per advertiser graph, 2008, 2009, 2010 were pretty flat.
Yeah,
when the housing market was really on its knees.
Yeah,
they couldn't grow the ARPA.
They couldn't, and obviously, you know, the ARPA is three times higher than that now. And so, if we get to a situation where the number of agents starts to fall, or you just get agents say, look, hey, I just can't afford this, and I'm going to move to Zoopla or On The Market, it's possible that this is the chink in the arm. And there are a couple of little chinks in Rightmove. They've not been able to grow their number of advertisers, and also the number of leads that they've been getting for those advertisers is a little bit below, or 10-15% below actually what they were getting 2-3 years ago. And Rightmove will argue that their quality of leads is still a lot better than everybody else, but just a bit of a sign there that for those who want to say, oh, is this peak Rightmove? And the dangerous thing with any sort of business model is if you are reliant on price rather than volume, i.e. selling more stuff to drive your revenue, there's always a little bit of concern there that sooner or later either the customer won't accept it and go somewhere else, or the economics of the customer's business just say, look, I just can't pay this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's seen the sell-off. And there's been quite a big sell-off in Rightmove. And the business has been derated.
As though the shares aren't expensive. I mean, 23 times earnings for a business like this doesn't seem eye-watering.
No, and it's interesting that the this week the Fundsmith small and mid-cap investment trusts announced Rightmove as one of their top 10 holdings.
Mm.
I can see why. I just think that this is a business that's done very, very well. In many, many ways, this is absolutely outstanding company on, as you say, not an eye-watering valuation for a business of this quality. I just think that you have to keep an eye. Obviously, no one knows when the housing market's going to turn down. It is turning down. The new build market is still supportive for Rightmove, but that's not the biggest chunk of its business. And then, obviously, we'll see what happens with the competition. But the competition is not really hurting this business at the moment. Mm-hmm. But very, very interesting study. And my guess is that it'll be a housing market downturn that'll stop this business in its tracks.
Yeah, which will come at some point. But then, you know, we kind of know what to look out for in terms of the kind of pain points that this company faces. And actually, you know, its quality will not disappear. There will be a housing correction. It's not going to go anywhere. There might be an opportunity to buy this company very cheaply at some point.
It comes down to, you know, the most important factor is what's this company's sustainable growth rate and how can it achieve it?
Mm.
Because I find it difficult to think how it can actually bring more estate agency advertisers on board. I think, you know, the market's pretty saturated now in terms of estate agents, even including online estate agents. And so I think it is very, very reliant on driving the price up. And that would be my main concern for this business.
One to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
Should we wrap up the podcast today with sandwiches?
Talk about Greencore then?
Yeah, let's talk about Greencore. I used to like this business.
Yeah.
You know, not a lot of people did.
No,
But it's done well over the years. Tried to get into North America.
Yeah, not very successfully. No. And it's now exited it.
Do they like sandwiches in North America? In the same way that we seem to eat nothing but sandwiches at lunchtime.
I don't know. The whole box sandwich thing isn't really a thing.
Yeah.
But we like our sandwiches. But apparently not as much as Greencore would have liked us to like our sandwiches. But because, yeah, it's now sold its U.S. business for just over $1 billion. And, yeah, it's a bit disappointing just in the sense that they had these big ambitions to grow the U.S. business. They'd bought this company called Peacock to sort of expedite that process. And it didn't work. And we had Greencore on a sale before this on the basis that the U.S. business was just a total drag. And we've now moved Greencore to a hold now that that U.S. business is gone. And some of the proceeds are going to be used to, well, the shareholders have an option to participate in a tender offer. And then apart from that, anything that's left over will be returned as like a special dividend.
And so lots of money coming back. Potentially.
It is, yeah. And I think it'll be in better shape after now that the US business is gone. I mean, it was a kind of a nice idea in theory and it just didn't pan out.
Mm. I mean, we talked about saturation in the estate agency market. I mean, the sandwich market is surely, there's not much room in the sandwich market.
Yeah, convenience foods, it's such a competitive business that it's, hard to really grow those profits.
But I guess Greencore, I mean, its strength is that it supplies so much of this market for so many customers.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, and I think it's done that quite well in the UK. I think that market will continue to be its core. And it tried to replicate that in the US and it didn't work. Mm. I think it's been so long standing in the UK that having that longevity has worked in its favour.
Another example of a British business going to America and not succeeding seems to be a common theme.
Oh, it's a famous quote, isn't it? The US is the graveyard of many British businesses. Mm. I think, you know, I think many companies have tried to make it out there. Sainsbury's, I think, many years back.
Yeah. Stagecoach.
Yeah, didn't M&S have a big push there?
M&S,
too, didn't
I
work.
Think,
yeah.
Tried.
Tesco.
Yeah. Tesco, oh my goodness, that was a disaster. Stick to the UK if you're a UK food business.
That's not to say that there aren't some. A lot of our engineering businesses have got successful US operations.
Well, that's true, and we talked about Diageo last week.
But we're hoping that the gamblers will do quite well over there too.
We are hoping that the gamblers do quite well over there.
Yeah.
But yes, I tried, tested, and quickly retreated from a route of expansion there, the US market. But Green Core, look, they look quite cheap. One to keep an eye on and see how it gets on with a renewed focus on the UK.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, well, that's all we have time for this week. There is there's plenty more in the magazine. We have Algy's looked at which sectors look in best shape for 2019, a screen he runs every year. It's pubs and restaurants that have come out again, Julia. Yeah, Julia's putting a face and Phil's waving his arms.
Pubs, maybe. Restaurants, I don't know.
I don't like either.
It's a mechanical screen, and yeah, they came out top last year, and it didn't really pan out that way in the end. Green King had some results this week.
Yeah. Did you look? Fine, it was all right. Meh. Yeah. World Cup was good.
Yeah. Expected. Absolutely. Sex Focus is on nickel, the commodity nickel. Which is apparently going to demand for, which is going to be underpinned by the electric vehicle boom, which never seems to happen as quickly as people think it's going to happen. The cover feature this week has a very Christmassy feel. We're looking at luxury goods and whether there's any value there. And actually, whilst a £136 Gucci tie, don't look at me, may seem overpriced, the shares in these companies still have a lot going for them. That's Harriet Russell's feature there on luxury goods. John Barron's in the magazine this week looking at the UK market and why it's perhaps as cheap as it's ever been, and attractively cheap rather than disgustingly cheap. And yeah, lots more in the news section, lots of results. Still about to wind down for Christmas now, thank goodness. Companies have finally put an end to the reporting season. And yeah, lots and lots of the usual excellent stuff. So thank you, Julia. Thank you, Phil. Thank you all for listening. I don't think we're going to do a normal Companies and Markets podcast next week, but I think, as is traditional, we do a big roundup, getting all the writers to talk about what's in store for their sectors in the year ahead. In the meantime, pick up this week's magazine, Worth It, Why It's Still Possible to Bag Share Bargains in Luxury Goods. We will catch up soon.